things operate, and particularly how they get the energy to make them go, which is really what one of the big things in biochemistry. I can only hint at it here. For one thing, I'm not an expert in the subject, and for another, that's not what the lecture is about. But it is a really fascinating subject, and there is a first-rate popular book on the subject by certainly the finest biochemical science writer of them all, and one of the very finest science writers of them all. I'm speaking, of course, of Isaac Asimov, and the book is called Life and Energy, and it's out in paperback, and it'll cost you like $1.95. And if you're turned on by this lecture at all, I think that book, too, you'll find fascinating. And it was something I found very, very useful to try to give me the background that I needed to understand what was going on in the Viking biology experiments. Believe me, people, astronomers, and my training is in astronomy, do not get organic chemistry in their education. Our educations are conducted on the assumption that the entire universe consists of monatomic gases, which, to a very close approximation, is the truth. It's just that the exceptions are what make life interesting, in fact, what make life. Well, the Leibniz experiment is looking for the oxidation side of the cycle. It is looking for organisms that are equivalent to animals on Earth. And so what you have got to do is you give your little beasties a nutrient, some organic chemicals that it can oxidize and break down, and then you try to detect the waste product of that oxidation, and the specific ones they try to detect is carbon dioxide. Okay? So it's very simple. You spray the nutrient onto the soil, very small amounts of it too, one drop at a time. Let's not be too un-Martian. And if you're gonna put this alien nutrient on the soil, don't soak it the way gas exchange does. Just give it a drop at a time, and then you look for carbon dioxide. Now, the way you detect the carbon dioxide is a very, very simple, sensitive method. Sensitive is the word that I'm looking for. You use radioactivity. You can detect radioactivity with a Geiger counter, and in fact, the Viking Biology package has in it the two most sensitive radiation detectors ever built by man. One in Leibniz and the other one in the third experiment, which I haven't described yet, pyrolytically, which also uses radioactive detection. Of the other side, in fact, I'll jump ahead and tell you, that's the one that looks for reduction, okay? So you got both possibilities covered. Well, carbon dioxide makes up 95% of the Martian air, right? And so if you simply take your label release experiment and you run it for a while and then you detect carbon dioxide, nobody's going to get very excited. You've got to prove that the carbon dioxide you are detecting has been produced in the experiment chamber by the process of reduction from the nutrients that you yourself supply. Otherwise, you haven't proved what you're trying to prove. And so what you do, how do you tell the carbon dioxide that was generated that way, probably in very small quantities, from the natural carbon dioxide that makes up the Martian air? Well, you arrange that your carbon dioxide is going to be radioactive. If you are oxidizing organic chemicals, and the carbon in those organic chemicals is ending up in carbon dioxide molecules, which you then detect, makes all of the carbon molecules in your nutrients radioactive, and then detect radioactivity that is given off. And that's exactly the way they work. So now you understand what was behind the press reports. Radioactive carbon dioxide has been discovered in the Martian soil. Yes, it was radioactive. It was not a natural constituent of the Martian soil, and those carbon atoms had never seen the Martian soil until they were sprayed onto it in the experiment chamber. And the reason they were radioactive is that they were made radioactive artificially back on Earth. As a matter of fact, they are the most famous isotope, the most famous radioisotope of all, carbon-14. That is totally irrelevant to the use of carbon-14 in archaeological dating, but, you know, for general interest, I mention it. Well, what they do in Leibniz release, then, is they spritz on their nutrient, and then they count radioactivity, which is coming off it, and, of course, you can do this continuously. And so you can watch the growth of the amount of carbon dioxide in your chamber, and that is a very important feature of this experiment. Gas exchange does the same thing, but so far gas exchange, it hasn't mattered because gas exchange doesn't detect as much of anything. But if you have light that is doing your oxidation, then you expect some sort of complex growth and decay curve over a long period of time. And if you do not have life, if the oxidation is being done by some non-living chemical reaction in the soil, which just happens to be capable of oxidizing your nutrients, why then you expect a different shape. Probably what you expect is that all of it's going to come out right away, and then it's going to plateau, and nothing more is going to happen. But it's not quite that simple, unfortunately. Remember that Mars may very well be an impoverished environment by the standards of Martian organisms, in the same way as it certainly is in the standards of Earth organisms. And there are plenty of desert soils on Earth which contain little beasties that lie down there waiting for dormant, waiting years and years and years for some sugar daddy to come along and finally supply them with nutrients. And when they do, they are programmed biochemically to gobble up those nutrients something fierce. And when they do that, they oxidize them, and they give off huge amounts of carbon dioxide all of a sudden, and then it plateaus, and then, after a much longer period of time, if the nutrients are still there and you're still able to rise, to live, then you slowly get the growth curve because they eat a lot faster than they reproduce. Doesn't everybody? So, let me show you now what they got when they first ran labor release on Viking Lander 1. And what I will do is draw you a graph in which this axis represents the amount of radioactive carbon dioxide, and this axis represents time. And this is going to be 0 days, and this is going to be only about 4 days here, like that. Okay, what happened was, you went along at a low background count. Remember, there's going to be radioactivity, and it's telling you the amount of carbon dioxide. But you have a low background count for a while, because any environment is slightly radioactive. And then, at this moment, right here, they added the carbon dioxide, they added the nutrients, and what happened was, wham! Like that. And then you got a plateau for a while. Well, that was in fact a more enthusiastic response than you get from even the most fertile Iowa farm soils on Earth when tested with this instrument. But it looked very much like the response you get from some of these infertile desert soils for the reasons that I just talked about. And so it could have been life and it could have been chemistry, and you wanted to wait and see what happened. Well, what they did next was to add a second drop of nutrient about 5 days into the experiment. Because there were two possibilities. One, that this oxidation was, well, the reason it had finally leveled off, you know, it's run out of something, obviously. What's it run out of? Has it run out of nutrients, and it simply needs more nutrients to oxidize, in which case it could very well be life. Or has it run out of whatever is doing the oxidizing, some chemical, in which case the chance would be very good that this would be non-living chemistry we're seeing. Okay? So, we're going to add another drop of nutrient, and if it stays level like this, then we're going to be suspicious that it's life. But if it does another big jump, then we're going to suspect that it is, in fact, what? We're not going to fill with proof, but it's going to be evidence for it. Okay? The one thing that absolutely nobody expected was what happened. What happened was, it went up a little bit like this, and then it dropped 30%. And remained at that level for days and days and days thereafter. This was the first of the little surprises that Mars had. No, I'm sorry, that was the second. The oxygen and the gas exchange got it first. This is the second. Well, obviously what happened, remember please that what we're counting here is the total amount of carbon dioxide that is in the sealed experiment chamber, okay? And so what has happened is something has eaten carbon dioxide. Now we've already shown the soil is alkaline, and that if you make it wet, then carbon dioxide goes back into the soil. What's apparently happened here is that it includes, of course, our radioactive carbon dioxide, and so some of the carbon dioxide that has previously been released was simply absorbed by the soil and was made a little bit wet. If that is true, and it's now believed that it is, then probably there actually tried to be a little drop here at the beginning,
except that it was so masked by whatever produced this big enthusiastic rise that you didn't notice. But what I'm saying is that if the soil weren't alkaline, that rise would have been even more enthusiastic than you're seeing. Okay? And so in the absence of something that produced that big rise, then you're going to have a drop. Okay, now, they let it run, and it stayed at this plateau for quite a number of days, and then a very, very interesting thing began to happen. Very slowly, the amount of carbon dioxide in the experiment chamber began to rise. Now, that in itself doesn't prove that you're seeing the rise. The question is what the rise is like. If you have non-living chemistry, the amount of the product, whatever it is, whatever the reaction you're talking about, that is produced as time goes on, tends to either stay the same, in other words, you have what's called a linear rise, because on this graph it looks like a straight line, okay, so this would be what a linear rise would look like, or it tends to fall off with time as the amount of the substance that is being, that is taking part in the reaction is used up. But if you have light, you tend to get what is called an exponential rise, and the reason for that, I'll tell you more about exponential rise is that the reason for that is that living things increase their numbers as they go along, okay? And an exponential rise means that, unlike a linear rise, where after, say, one day you've got a certain amount of the stuff, after 2 days you've got twice as much, after 3 days you've got three times as much, 4 days you've got four times as much, that's a linear rise. An exponential rise means the numbers after successive numbers of days go like 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and so on. You double each day, or each whatever period is. Because the period in which you're doubling is the period that it takes for them to reproduce one, the period of one generation. Okay? The more living things you have, the more waste product they're producing, and so you get an exponential rise, which looks something like that, and just really takes off and goes sky high, except that finally you run out of some living nutrient and it begins to die off, and so your exponential rise turns around and dies. But before that, you got the exponential rise, and that exponential curve is the characteristic signature of life. Well, what happened was, in the first 3 days of it, it looked like the very, very beginning of an exponential rise. And the problem is that I think you can see from my diagram here, at the very beginning, it's hard to tell, right, because the curves look similar toward the beginning. An exponential rise has the characteristic that it gets more and more extreme as time goes on, and so if you get a little of it at the very beginning, it's hard to tell that's what it is. But the mathematical analysis of the first 3 days, they look more as though we're exponential than linear. All right, so you're really waiting, I'm sure, for what happens after 10 days or after 20 days. Unfortunately, the experiment was programmed to terminate automatically there. Had they had 4 days warning, they could have set up revised commands not to terminate the experiment. But they had 3 days warning. And so just as that rise began, the experiment terminated, it automatically flushed out of the chamber, we go back to the background level, and that. Okay, end of description of the first run on Bikingminder 1. And let me note that this was run at 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Clearly, the next thing to do, well, clearly at this point, the scientists were definitely of two minds about it. There was one school of thought which said, for heaven's sake, let's repeat that, or next time do it 3 months or something and see what happens. But what seemed to be even more important, and what was already pre-programmed, which means that you had what's changing to have to do, was a control run on a heat sterilized sample of the same soil. Okay, remember the control run? That's where you heat it up to 320 degrees Fahrenheit and hope that you won't get a response. All right? Here is what happened on the control run. Bikingminder 1, this is run 2, which was the control. You went along, you had a little bit higher level of background because there was a little bit of CO2 left over from the first experiment that had been totally flushed out of the chamber. That doesn't matter. As long as you know what the background is, you can ignore it. And what happened was, as soon as they dropped in the nutrients, you had a strip up and then it fell back down just the way I told you it ought to have. And then what happened was, it stayed at essentially zero level for the entire time that they ran the experiment, which was the next time. Just what you would expect with life. So let me label this one 320 degrees Fahrenheit. And let me point out that although 320 degrees Fahrenheit is a very high temperature by the standards of living things, it is not a terribly high temperature by the standards of normal inorganic chemistry. And there are very few chemicals which are so heat sensitive that they will give you a big response at 50 degrees Fahrenheit and they're destroyed at 320. So you see that whole heat sterilization idea is a very good, a very sensitive test. Really powerful heat as to whether it's light or non-light. Light is very temperature sensitive. That's a characteristic of it. And the reason it's not hard to understand from what I told you is because it is made of such terribly delicate, complex molecules. A little increase in temperature and you really mess up those molecules. Inorganic chemistry is made of simpler and therefore hardier molecules. Consider what happens if your own temperature, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, rises just a mere 10 degrees. It's nothing except by the standards of light. If your temperature goes up to 108.6 Fahrenheit, unless it goes down within a few hours, you are dead. And yet, you name a non-living chemical reaction that's going to produce that kind of drastic difference with such a 10 degree temperature. You see what I mean? Okay. On Viking Lander 2, the thing is, I'm jumping ahead now. We're going to do more experiments on Lander 1. I'm deliberately going out of chronological sequence just so as to wrap this up. On Viking Lander 2, on the first run, it was a duplicate of this, and it was exactly the same result, but I'm not going to draw the diagram again. It's the same curve, except that in the first place, the initial rise was higher. And that is very, very interesting because there were already people who were suggesting that what we were seeing here, what was causing this oxidation, remember there is one powerful oxidizing chemical in the Martian soil, namely this mysterious stuff, whatever it was that you discovered by Messerschmitt. Alright? And so there are already people who are suggesting that what we are seeing here in this oxidation was that substance attacking the nutrient, specifically attacking the sodium formate, which of all the seven nutrients is the easiest one to oxidize, and using that up, and that it was not light. Alright, remember please that at the Viking Lander 2 site, there was less of this mysterious oxidant in the soil, and yet you got a higher response from label frequency. Okay? So that is definitely evidence against this having been caused by oxidation of the formate, at least by that substance. Of course, you can always say, well, look, if there's one weird chemical in the soil which happens to have been detected by our particular experiment gas exchange, maybe there are 16 other oxidants, and this one just happens to be another one, and maybe there's more of that at the Lander 2 site. Okay, so it certainly isn't proving that it's light, but all I can do here is give you the very piece of evidence for and against. All right, let's go to the Viking Lander 1 third cycle. Now you think this was going to be a long run, but it turned out that by this point they were running into engineering problems due mainly to funding restrictions, and it turns out they weren't able to do a long run yet for the third cycle because it would require too much reprogramming, and they didn't have the personnel to spare from other things that were needed at the same time to do the reprogramming. And so what they did was, in biology, since you were dealing with such very complex phenomena, you tend not to believe a response until you see it more than once. There's so many variables involved in biological systems that the first time should have been a freak. And so one of the things they try to do when they get an indication of what the soap would be like is duplicate it. And what they really like to do is try to duplicate it on the other lander. So far, Lander 2 hasn't landed yet. I told you I gave you that first one from Lander 2 out of sequence. And so what they did was they wanted to duplicate the results on the first run there, the black one, 50 Fahrenheit, by doing another 50 Fahrenheit run in the hope of getting the same identical curve. Unfortunately, there was a glitch. There was a little problem with the spacecraft. The heaters in the experiment got a little bit too enthusiastic. And for the first 3 days, until they found out this was happening and were able to send up corrective measures to get rid of it, instead of being at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, the soil was at 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? Only 30 degrees difference. So that's not going to matter very much. And if it's non-living chemistry, it certainly ought not matter very much. So, in fact, it turned out that, unbeknownst to anybody, this was really a nice, powerful control experiment, and it was a good thing that the glitch occurred. If we get the same response, chances are it's non-living. And if we get a very different response, it could very well be living. Well, in fact, the response they got was the same shape of curve, but quite a bit higher. So it is a very temperature-sensitive phenomenon. And furthermore, notice the way the sensitivity is going. You start at 50 Fahrenheit, you make it a little bit warmer, and you get much more of it. But you make it a great deal warmer, and you get much less of it. Doesn't that sound like life? Isn't that the way you behave, for example? Okay. Only one more to tell you about. No, two more to tell you about. And that'll be the end of this lecture, and then, you know, we'll start off in the next one where I'm reading off here, and I'll tell you the fiber ready for these results. So, this is going to be a long lecture. Keep the fresh graph for that. In fact, let me see if I can leave that on so that you can...
Yeah, good. We do have enough space for this.
All right. And now I'm going to draw another graph like this. And I already told you the first run on Viking Lander 2. And so now I'm going to tell you the second run on Viking Lander 2. And by then they were getting really fancy because they had begun to realize that this whole question of temperature sensitivity was one of great importance. And so they did a very clever thing, which the instrument was never designed to do, and which was due again to something that went wrong, in this case, a slight design failure. The heater, which is used for sterilizing the soil, for heating to 320 degrees Fahrenheit, turned out, when the instrument was tested, not to be quite good enough. Now, if everything had gone perfectly well, the heater would have been adequate. But if they had had a little bit of underrun of voltage or whatever, it would not have heated to a sufficient temperature. And so, by way of being absolutely certain, the engineers simply added another heater, a reserve heater, to be sure if they had enough. Somebody in the Viking biology team got a very clever idea of sterilizing some soil using only the reserve heater. And the reserve heater used by itself would heat it only to 125 degrees Fahrenheit instead of 320. So we get yet another number here. And so what they wanted to see was, will you get a still higher curve of the same shape, or will you drop down to this one, or will you maybe get something in between? And anyway, it would have given you another handle on the whole question of temperature sensitivity. Well, by this time, you have come to realize that Mars is going to think of a completely different response to any of the possibilities which you consider possible, and it did. Here is what happened when they did this so-called cold sterilized run at 125 degrees Fahrenheit. What happened was, here's the background. Sorry, I'll use the black one here. Here's the background, and we inject the first drop of nutrient, and we have the usual sudden jump, and then it drops back down. And then, after about a day, it began to rise, and then it began to fall back again. And then we went along for a while, and then we had another rise, and then it fell back again. And then we went along a while, and we had another rise, and then it fell back again. And then we went along, and et cetera, dot, dot, dot. Because it just kept doing it until they terminated the experiment. There was one rise and one fall every Martian day. The rise was at the same time every Martian day, but the fall was not. You had an additional rise and fall each time you added a drop of nutrients. And that's what happened in the cold sterilization cycle, and so I'll label this 125 degrees Fahrenheit. And the first response, which by the way was the first response every time they get something new and unexpected, and by this time I think you begin to realize that practically means every time they do another run. The first response of the experimenters was, there's something wrong with the instrument. And so they put it through all kinds of tests and nobody could find anything wrong with the instrument. And to jump ahead of the story, I'll tell you the whole thing, it's only one sentence. They did another run on Viking Lander 2, which was a duplicate. They still want to duplicate this first 50 degree Fahrenheit run. You know, it was nice they had the accident where there was the 80 Fahrenheit. They still want to duplicate it at some point. And they did exactly that, and they did it with a sample taken from under a rock, where for reasons I've already mentioned, they thought there might be a higher probability of life. And it essentially did duplicate the result on Viking Lander 1 first run, which is nice. slightly different amount of the rise and so on, but, you know, you don't expect them to be exactly the same in a different energy rate. So, the point of that is, you got what they call the classical curve, and the point of that is the instrument seems to be working just fine, because they ran it again after this, and, you know, it did not do anything peculiar, and didn't give you these little shark fin or rose thorn or whatever you call them, wiggles every day. So apparently, those wiggles are in fact quite real. And what it is that is causing, we have a foggiest motion. If you want to assume that what you are seeing there is a circadian rhythm in some Martian organism, feel free. It's a good explanation of anything else. It's also possible that there was something or other funny going on inside a spacecraft which only operated briefly. It's not a matter of the different temperature. Remember, please, the soil in the experiment chamber isn't heated to 125 degrees Fahrenheit when they're doing the run. Okay, so it's not as though there's something funny about 125 degrees Fahrenheit that makes the instrument behave differently from the way the instrument operates at 50. The instrument is at 50 all the time. It's just a matter of, when I say 125, you heated the soil to that temperature for a time, and then cool it off and put it back into the experiment chamber. It's not run all the time at 125. And so, apparently, all I can say is there is something in the Martian soil which, as you heat it to 125 Fahrenheit, every day gives off a little carbon dioxide, and it's an Indian giver, takes it right back to you. And gives it off again the next day, and takes it back to you the next day. So it's like taking home the strength of all. The only remaining thing to say is that Viking Lander 2, the third run, which was the duplication, remember this one? They finally did manage to get the long run that they wanted all along. And that long run did indeed show the little rise here at the end, but it was not at all exponential. It was linear and it was quite gentle. So that's not evidence against the existence of life on Mars. It's evidence against this particular feature having been caused by a living process instead of a non-living process. Okay? I hope that you are now all feeling totally bewildered. If so, I have succeeded in bringing you up to date on weight. Next time, I will make you at least as bewildered with pyrolytic release, because believe me, folks, I have a sense of dramatic enough to save the best for last. And when you see the pyrolytic release results, they will make even these look tame. And then when you are totally confused, I will discuss all the various alternates, and that will be the end of the lecture. And I'll send you home wondering what's going on, and being very happy that there are nice little volcanoes on Mars that you can understand. Thank you. Now, as usual, anybody who has questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them, give a chance for people who want to leave to do so.
Yeah. Is there going to be a new test for neutrinos other than the Homestake mine? Do they have no way?
We found a sugar daddy that will buy us, what is it, 500 tons of indium, which is the best recent suggestion for a much more sensitive test and a much more direct test. So far, to the best of my knowledge, no. I mean, there's not really, you know, in an ideal world where you had infinite money, you like to, one of the cornerstones of science is reproducibility, you like to build another instrument somewhere else and rerun the experiment. But this isn't an ideal world, we don't have infinite money. And there is nobody that I know of who...
No, here he is.
Well, okay, they're taking my microphone away, so why don't the people in the back move down here, because I've already gotten a sore throat.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right if they just move down the front, that's fine.
Yes,
there you
okay,
go.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Can I get an address?
Yeah, do you have a pencil and paper?
No, but I'm sure
so. Okay, well, why don't you dig up a pencil and paper and get your address or slide. Space photos. 2608 Sunset Boulevard. You never guess the name of the city. It begins with an H. Houston, Texas. 77005. I'll give you a phone number if you want it. Area 713-667-9668. There are many commercial firms which sell slides, faking and otherwise. I certainly can't claim to have seen all of them, and I'm sure there are many others that are fine. There are also many that are terrible. I've dealt with space photos for many years. I've always been happy with them, and they have some features that I really like. First of all, their slides are inexpensive. They're four for $1.25. And secondly, they do sell them in small sets, only four each, so you don't have to buy 50, you know, to get the one or two that you want, as you very often do in these things. You buy a whole set of Viking slides. They have an illustrated catalog with a picture of every single one of their slides, so you can see exactly which one you're getting. And they never, never take a slide out of print. So, all in all, I recommend it. Yeah, a catalog will cost you 50 cents, or it's free with an order. So, write and ask for their Viking catalog, and they'll probably just send you their Viking catalog, and then when you send your order for the Viking slides, ask for everything else if you're interested in other things. And they've got really nice selections, and they're one of my standard sources. Of course, you realize that many of the slides that I've shown in the first three lectures were the worst slides, were ones that I made myself from printed sources, and those you can't get. But the Martian Sunset will turn it. Now, there are other firms that sell them. I don't know about
that.
Yeah.
There's
some
of this
last ramp. Yeah,
the
shark thing.
You said that
rose
every day
is precise. Well, more or less. I don't know, plus or minus half an hour or so.
And what time
was it? Oh. Gee, that's a very good question, and I don't know, and it's not in my notes. There was nothing obvious about the times that struck my attention when I heard them, which is why I didn't write them down in my notes, but I still wish I could answer the question because, you know, something might strike you that didn't strike me. I don't think it was anything like sunrise or sunset. On the other hand, if it is circadian rhythm, remember that if you're put into a darkened room for a circadian rhythm study, you very quickly get most people very quickly get out of phase with the outside world, even though that's why they call them circadian rhythm, approximately dead. You know, so it probably wouldn't prove a whole lot, even if it were. As I remember, that particular soil sample had sat around in the hopper for a while before they started the run. You know, so they might have gotten out of phase already, if in fact it was organisms, which, you know, I'm not claiming that it is or isn't. Yeah. Sorry about that. That is a good question. I'll try to look that up for you during the coming week, until next week.
Did you mention
something about L5? L5 Society is a private organization which is interested in space colonization, and their address is 1920 North Park Avenue, Tucson, Arizona. I don't know the zip code, but the post office will find it. Well, of course, L5 Society took its name from the suggestion that the first colony be built at the Lagrangian point of the European system, which is generally called L5. Although it's beginning to look as though L2 may be better, which is really going to be a problem. The L5 Society has to change its name. Other questions? Yeah.
If you had a space colony, you'd have to have a shuttle, and I think like I heard something about it being tested soon or something.
That's right.
Or could be an update in it.
Well, the first shuttle orbiter built, which was the Enterprise and which was rolled out last September, is in fact configured for testing, which involves quite a bit of modification, so much so that it will have to be rather extensively rebuilt before they can fly it into space. And it will be the second orbiter built, number 102, no name yet, which I'm sure they'll call a Constitution because that's what NASA wanted to call the Enterprise until they were overruled. That'll be the first one into space, and that's March of 79. The Enterprise has just been trucked, and I mean literally trucked, 35 miles through the desert, which wasn't exactly the easiest thing in the world, they had to close the highways. There's only one road, and they got this enormous 90-wheel transporter and put it on it to take up four lanes of highway. And they, this was 2 days ago, they trucked it across the desert from Palmdale, California, the Rockwell National Plant where it was built, to Edwards Air Force Base, which is where Dryden Flight Research Center is, which is where the ALT, the approach and landing tests, what you're talking about, will be done. And that was quite an event. It was covered on television. I'm sorry you missed it. It was on Monday. It's probably the last you'll hear on television about the shuttle for a long time. And it was very dramatic from what I'm told. They started at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they started in pitch blackness, and then you had this beautiful desert sunrise. And they got all kinds of spectacular pictures of the orbiter against the desert sunrise. And you've got to imagine this huge vehicle, the size of a small jet airplane, being rolled slowly along the highway through that incredible Joshua Tree desert, you know, with the distant mountains in the background, the sun just rising, and it must have been quite a scene. And the only available route went through downtown Lancaster, California, and past a couple of shopping centers on the outside, the outskirts of town. And the whole town turned out to watch it go by. It was quite a festive occasion. Room 93 of the Joshua Elementary School turned out with a banner saying, "Welcome Shuttle," and all this kind of stuff. And it's quite a people's occasion. Well, what will happen is, see, the way the shuttle comes back from orbit is not the way you'd expect when you look at a picture of the orbiter part of it. You understand the orbiter is only one part, but it's the one that actually goes into space and comes back to the Earth. And it looks like an airplane, but it is not an airplane, and it doesn't fly like an airplane. And in fact, its bottom surface, which is the aerodynamically important one, is not an airplane-shaped surface. But you don't realize that when you see a picture of it from the usual angle. It flies rather like a rock. And nobody's ever flown a rock before. And so what they've got to do is learn how to land it, particularly. The takeoff is no problem. You sit there, and you let the rocket do the work, and you take off vertically, and we know how to do that. And flying around in space, we know how to do that. No matter what shape it is. But when it comes back into the Earth's atmosphere, you enter the Earth's atmosphere about 90 miles up, going at 16,000 miles an hour. And thereafter, the shuttle, until just before the runway, comes down at a vertical rate of 1 mile per minute, which is only about twice the horizontal rate. And I think you will agree your average airplane does not fly that kind of profile. And then just short of the runway, when you are still going at Mach 1 or thereabouts, you pitch up the nose 45 degrees, and this has exactly the effect that you would think. That is, you are slowed so violently that, in fact, the thermal tiles glow cherry red again, just the way they did when you hit the atmosphere in the first place. And that is called a momentum dump, or a flare. And after having gone through that particular hair-raising maneuver, you then taxi to a stop on the runway, which is 10,000 feet long, a number that sounds generous only before you see it coming towards you. Of course, at Edwards, you've got 10 miles of dry lake overrun that you should run off the end of the runway, but under normal circumstances, they won't have that. Well, you got to learn how to do that. Oh, yes, I forgot to mention the little detail that you have no fuel during this entire period. It's the world's biggest glider. And that means you only got one chance. Now, that's standard. You know, any pilot is taught how to make an emergency landing with no fuel, and your plane will come down and land like a glider. But they're going to do it routinely here, and they're going to do it with something that isn't a plane. It's a rock. And it's going to be kind of hair-raising learning how to fly it. Well, the obvious way to learn how to fly it without actually taking it into space is to take it up a few miles and let it drop and, you know, have some test pilots on board, and astronauts are test pilots, and in fact they're using astronauts for these tests, two crews of them, each two men, take it up and let it drop down and, you know, do some tests. And there are eight such tests scheduled, and they're in July, and they're called ALTs, as I said. But before you can do that, you've got to test out the method of getting it up there, because the method they chose is rather dramatic in itself. What you do is you take the entire orbiter and you mount it on the back of a 747. And then you take off with the world's largest airplane and another airplane on its back. And nobody's ever flown something like that before either. So the first thing they have to do is to learn how to handle that, hopefully in a way that will not destroy the orbiter. Not to mention the 747, which NASA bought bought used, the budget being what it is these days, a buyer from American Airlines. Spent a year rebuilding it until it's really not a 747 anymore, except on the outside. Really highly modified. And the 747 has a four-man crew. And so what they've got to do is, first of all, learn how it handles with the orbiter on top. And so tomorrow, they will begin the first of a series of taxi runs. They start out very modestly. They don't even take off. They simply put the orbiter on the 747, which will be quite a sight to see, as I think you can imagine, and truck her out on the end of the runway and let her sit there for a while and see what the wind does to this configuration and what metal fatigue do, whatever it might do, and then truck it back in. And there will be five of those taxi runs, more or less, the exact number they'll decide on. The next thing to do, which is in May, if I remember correctly, is a captive inert test, of which there will be five. And the captive inert tests are where you take off with the configuration, and there's nobody on board the orbiter, and the orbiter systems aren't even turned off, that's why you say inert. And you fly it up a few miles and then turn around and come back home. And meanwhile, of course, measuring furiously every variable you can think of to see how it's flying. And there are five of those. And then there are five captive live tests in which you still don't release it. You know, so we haven't released the orbiter from the 747 yet. But the systems will be live and the astronaut crew will be on board, and so they'll all be watching. And then assuming all this goes well, the ALTs proper, as I mentioned, are in July. The next stage then, after they have learned how to fly it with the 747, which will be used not only for the ALTs, but also throughout the shuttle era to ferry the orbiters back and forth from wherever they have to be carried. So no more trucking on the ground, I'm afraid. That was a one-shot kind of event. And the next time it has to be carried to Dryden, no others will be carried to Dryden. Orbiter 102 will be flown direct from Palmdale to Cape Canaveral, where it will take off, and that will be on the back of the 747. And then we want to go from one launch site to the other launch site with a given orbiter and so forth, use the 747. So that will be in use all the time for that. Well, the next stage is to ferry it to Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, where it will early next year be mated with the other components of the shuttle, which are the external tank and the two solid rocket boosters, both of which are now in the final stages of construction. And then they will put it in their big vibration test facility at Marshall and shake it in a way that reproduces what will happen during a launch to make sure that the configuration is in fact as sound as I think it is. And assuming that all that goes well, the first launch into space is in March of 1971. And that will be with 102. See, 101 is used for the vibration test as well as the ALT.
The size of the car surprised me. Was it 50 ton or 150 ton?
The shuttle?
Yeah.
I don't remember the weight of the orbiter itself, but I do know the size of the cargo bay, and it's about the size of two moving vans back to back. It's 60 feet long and 15 feet in diameter, and you could put within it the entire Mercury Redstone vehicle, including the Redstone, which made our first manned flight into space.
Well, for starting out when we're learning something, that seems to be something larger than what I would think would be necessary.
Well, yeah, see, in the Apollo days, they would have done all this kind of testing on scale models before they ever hazarded a real spacecraft. They just haven't got the money for that kind of thing now. And so they're doing it with the real thing, and hoping they'll get away with it. And it's not quite as risky as it probably sounds, because we've come a long way since Apollo days, especially since Apollo testing days, and we know a good deal more now about how to build these things and how to fly them. And also, we have very sophisticated computer simulation techniques, which were not available then. And of course, lots of those have been run. They're a lot cheaper than building a scale model and a big wind tunnel and so forth and so on. And so the tests are being done on the real orbiter. But yeah, there's certainly no question that it's a risk. You know, for example, one of the safety features is the 747 can, if necessary, jettison the orbiter. Can you imagine how you would feel after you had just jettisoned the orbiter? But, you know, it's the kind of risk we've got. And that's one of the inherent risks of a space program based on a reusable vehicle. You know, a reusable vehicle is a great idea. It saves you tons of money. But you've only got a few of them. And if anything happens to one of those, it's not It's not just the loss of one emission the way it would have been if something happened to one of our old expendable kinds of rockets. It's the loss of one-fifth of your space program since five shuttles are being built. Got a hand somewhere. Yep, yeah.
I'm just doing the experiment. When you take the soil test, and after you've done the experiments with it, what happens?
It is dumped into an internal chamber within the spacecraft. It is not put back out on Mars again.
How many experiments can it hold?
Well, the dump chamber is not the limit on how many experiments you can do. The limit, in fact, is turning out to be, at first they thought it would be the number of experiment chambers, but then it turned out that where the action was in several of them was a long run to see if you could get some slow exponential response started. And so they turned out to have more experiment chambers than actually needed in all the pyrolytic release. Only pyrolytic release is actually going to use up every one of its chambers. And the others are going to be limited by the amount of helium. I have told you how the biology package works, and in fact I was going to say something about this next week anyway, but one of the many remarkable features of it is that instead of having motors to move things around inside, which means moving parts, which means possibility of failure, everything is moved by streams of pure helium, which are simply squirted against anything that you want to move, and of course it's in a channel, you know, and it moves along. And the helium is also used to pressurize the test cells and so forth. Helium is used for everything in there. Well, we started out with 70,000 cubic centimeters of helium, and you're now down to about a fifth of that, and we're going to run out of helium on both spacecraft, actually just about the same time, as it turns out, because one of them was used for a little bit more energetic testing than the other, turns out. And that'll be somewhere around May. They can't predict it too well, but May plus or minus a month or thereabouts.
So will that end the experiment?
Yeah. That's the end. But let me point out, they're doing about 60% as much work after conjunction, after the period that Mars is behind the Sun there, than they had done up to that time. And so far, I've told you only results of labeled release through conjunction. I'm sorry, it's not true. I told you the only remaining result to date through conjunction, which was the long run, did not produce an exponential response. Okay, so I take that back. But there is, in fact, quite a lot more being done. And what I'll do at the very end next week is tell you what happened next. And I'll give you, in fact, the whole rest of the schedule for all three experiments. Yeah?
Was there any cell detection?
No. Aside from the seismometer, which is sound detection in a sense, but certainly not the word means. We cannot hear the howling of the Martian wind. It's kind of a shame, actually. One of the more imaginative and one of the very few knowledgeable reporters out there was trying to talk the seismology team into producing a tape recording of the sound if they ever got a quake for a broadcast. And I don't know if anything ever came of that. In fact, I think of it now they've got something that might be a quake. Maybe I should get in touch with Don Anderson and see if I can talk him out of that and put it on National Public Radio. It's kind of neat. It's rather faked because you have to change the frequency a lot from what it is to be able to hear it. But still, you know, just to be able to put it on that way makes it a little more real, I should think.
Well, it's not like the blue sky.
Right.
On this program you're doing in Ann Arbor, what's the scheduling for that? You told me February 11th begins, but what's the scheduling for the day?
Most of them are already over, and you can pick up a mimeograph schedule when you're out there. He's talking about something called the Astronomical Film Festival, which actually includes lectures as well. As a matter of fact, this coming one is going to be nothing but a lecture, and it's going to be the one that you're hearing right now. And it's just going to be the same thing.
No, after February 11th. Okay.
No, after February 11th, we go to something completely different, which is something that I have been dreaming about for 5 years, and the most ambitious thing we've ever done. We're going to put on an entire Apollo mission. Apollo 16, every last minute of it, 21 hours worth. We've been able to get the one of two copies in the world of the color sound kinescope of the complete EVAs on Apollo 16, and that will be on two successive weekends in March. That'll be quite an event.
So we'll be able to get information on the date?
Yeah.
We won't be able to make the 11th.
I see. Well, yeah, as I say, you know, why should you? I mean, it's just the same thing that you're hearing here. Unless you want to hear it all over again, but you're taping it, you can do that anytime you want.
But you're not running out of policy.
I'm sorry, I can give you the dates for Apollo 16 on the bridge, but I can't give you the times necessarily because, I'm sorry, I can give you that also. It's in Ann Arbor. It's free. It's open to the public. It's in Auditorium 3, Modern Languages Building, 812 East Washington Street. And the dates are Saturday, March 19th. I'm sorry. Friday, March 18th. Sorry, I don't have the times here. What I have is the times we have the auditorium signed out, and that's not the same because we get that rowing set up.
What time is that? Is this going to be the...
Anyway, evening? Anybody who's interested in this, write me a letter at University of Michigan, Exhibit Museum Planetarium, 1109 Geddes Avenue, G-E-D-D-E-S Avenue.
What's the number?
1109 Geddes Avenue. Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48109. Include a stamped self-addressed envelope and simply write the word schedule on the outside. I know what you mean. You don't have to write me a whole letter. And, I mean, unless you want to. But, you know, just or put astronomy schedule on the outside. And we'll get a copy right off to you. The Astronomical Film Festival is something I've been doing for 7 years now. And we get quite a big crowd now. We get about 500 people. So I have the feeling that I can do something esoteric and have somebody show up, you know, and it's really going to be neat. In addition to the whole of Apollo 16, we'll have a whole lot of other related films and lectures and so on. There are six programs altogether, which half are the actual presentation of Apollo 16, and the other half are commentary. That'll be quite a thing. Been wanting to do that ever since Apollo 16 itself, which was the first Apollo mission that was not broadcast in its entirety by the network, and perhaps the most important of the whole set.
Because
warm teeth look like an entree. Yeah. We won't show it all simultaneously, though. Go ahead, please. Okay, it's 10 o'clock. Why don't we take one more question and adjourn for the night. Anybody? Yeah.
You kind of confused me when you said the Enterprise was going to be mounted on the back of a 747, wasn't it supposed to be mounted under the wing? No, because we had...
Too big for that. They used to do that with the X-15. They put it under the wing of the B-52. There's no way you can... wing was a B-52. But there's no way you can do that with... No, that was never intended. There were all kinds of good possibilities. There was a brief period there when there was some hope that they might decide for the ferry vehicle to have a blimp. And... you know, people who are hoping for the resurgence of the airship were very enthusiastic about that, but that against it, apparently.
Did they
ever
pass around the idea of putting it on the wing? Did I remember seeing the picture?
Sketch of it.
I don't know.
Too big?
Yeah, I tell you, it's the size of the DC-9 without the wing, so you can imagine the size.
Sure. And in fact, I'll tell you something, I was there for the rollout last September. It's bigger than you think it is. My most forceful impression was, gee, that thing is big. You know, because I would say it's the size of the smallest of the standard jet airliners, but it's higher than that, and it's bulkier than that. And it's really a big thing. It would be able to weigh 65,000 pounds in the most favorable case. And that means that it could put into orbit 5 full-grown male African elephants, which are the heaviest kind. We call that the herd shot down the world. So, that sounds like a good place to stop. Thank you. That was a somewhat more dramatic opening than I intended. If I can't get this... wire pulled out any further, it's going to be more dramatic than that when I try to step off the podium. I think the format that we sort of accidentally drifted into the last few weeks of starting out with questions from last time and then thereby giving latecomers a chance to show up is a good one, and so why don't we do that if you... I know I threw an awful lot of biochemistry at you last week, and you've had a week to think about it now, and if anyone... would like their confusion elevated to a higher level, I'll be more than happy to try to do so. Anybody? Yeah?
Thank you so much. Do you have the time for the Apollo thing you're planning?
Okay, yeah. What I did here, and I guess I could mention this as well now as later, I brought along a whole stack, literally more than we might need, because, you know, take some for your friends if you want, of the University of Michigan. You do not have this, even if you've been out there and picked up a copy, because this is a brand new version. It was only run off on Monday, and this is the revised version, which does indeed have exactly what you're asking about. At the Astronomical Film Festival, which I do at the University of Michigan, we are going to have next month the most elaborate thing that we have ever done, and something I've been dreaming about for 5 years. We are going to do the entire Apollo 16 flight, every last minute of it. And we are also going to have all kinds of subsidiary programs with commentary by me and films that are relevant and so forth and so on. I don't know, this one makes no apologies. This is for the real space freaks only. Anybody with only casual interest is not going to care about it, because it's really going to be something that you have to be there for all of them. They're just too interconnected, and it won't be possible to give all the explanations over and over again at the beginning of each program. But for those of you who are willing to go out there and, just camp for two successive weekends and see what an Apollo flight was like, some of the younger kids, this is going to come as a shock to the older people, I'm sure, but some of the younger kids have never seen one. And no one has ever seen Apollo 16. That's one of the reasons that I picked it. It was the first mission that the network did not broadcast in its entirety, and that was really a shame for at least two separate reasons. One, it was probably the most entertaining of the whole set to watch, just because of the particular astronauts who had to be in the crew. And number two, scientifically, it may have been the most important of the entire series. So all the information about that is in here, and also the information about other things about astronomy that happened at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, many of which are free and all of which are open to the public. The information about the adult classes that I teach both in Ann Arbor and in Detroit through the university courses in adult education is here as well. And if anybody would like to hear me give some lectures about Mars, I can't imagine such a thing, but if you would, we're going to, starting in April, we are going to have an 8-part course, which is called The New Mars, and which is going to be all the material you've had here, plus a bunch of other stuff, because there will be eight of them 2 hours each, instead of five of them an hour and a half each. And so all that is here, and you are most welcome to take these, and if you have friends that are interested, take some for them. The only reason we didn't just put these in the back and let you grab them on the way in was that, after all, most people probably won't be interested in stuff in Ann Arbor, and we figured there'd be a horrible litter problem if we had a pile there with no explanation, and lots of people grabbed them and then realized it wasn't what they were interested in, so I thought I'd tell you what they were first. But they're up here, and you're most welcome to take as many copies if you like. Well, then I try to find it. This is going to be a problem. Donna, help! Okay. We're kind of tangled over there, and if I try to disentangle it, I know from experience it's just going to make it worse. Okay, who's got another question? Anybody? Interested? Everything I told you last week, that's incredible. That's truly amazing. You mean to tell me you're already for the final exam this early? Gee, I don't know. Okay, great. All right, yeah, that's a good idea. So why don't they will be in the back then? Okay, so. The other thing that I had better explained to you to understand, it is water that I'm drinking. So if you notice a progressive increase in the quality of the lecture as we go along, it is coincidental. I've got a very bad cold, and it started out with a sore throat, and it's now mostly moved up into my head, and I have hopes that it will stay there, but no way I'm going to get through this lecture without some lubrication, particularly since there's another, I have to give the same lecture basically plus last week, so a long version combining the two in order tomorrow night, and if anybody really wants to go through the whole thing again, you're welcome to come out to Ann Arbor tomorrow night for the Astronomical Film Festival series. It is not described in the brochure, but it is in the same place. Tomorrow night it's not, because the brochure starts out with the March programs. However, tomorrow night is at the same place, and it's at 8 o'clock, and so that ought to be terribly difficult. It's just imagine that it's one of the Friday programs that are described in the brochure, and you'll have time, place, and everything else. And that is free, and it's open to the public. So, okay, those of you, I guess it's only fair to warn you too, if you weren't here last week, you're not going to understand a word we say this week. because there's just no way I can run over the whole thing all over again, you know. So if somebody runs screaming for the door at this point, I'll understand. And, you know, you're welcome to come out to Ann Arbor tomorrow night to pick up the entire thing. Bring your sleeping bag. It's going to be both lectures combined, so it'll be kind of long. Last week, I gave you the results from two of the three Viking biology instruments, and those were gas exchange and labeled release. And you will recall that I promised to pick that up this week and give you the third one, pyroidic release, and also the two that have release in their names, labeled release, which I talked to, which I finished the talk about last week, and pyroidic release, which I'm about to begin with. Those two are opposite to one another in the sense that one of them, labeled release, that I talked about last week, looks for oxidation, and the one I'm about to talk about, pyroidic release, looks for its exact chemical opposite, which is reduction. And oxidation, in this particular context, means what animals do on the earth, that is, taking complex organic materials and breaking them down into simpler things, specifically carbon dioxide, which the experiment then detects. The process generates energy. You get energy out by doing this, and that is the energy on which animals, including you and me, operate. Well, those complex organic chemicals that we break down had to come from someplace. They are the chemicals that are in the plants that we eat, or the animals that we eat, which in turn got them from the plants that they eat. Those chemicals were the bodies of the plants, and they were built up by the plants by the opposite process, the process of reduction. Reduction, in this context, means, and it's confusing that it's called reduction, because it's not a breakdown, it's a build-up, but nevertheless, chemically it comes out as what's called reduction. Reduction, in this context, means taking simple things such as carbon dioxide, water, and so forth, and building them up into complex substances, organic substances, of which the plants themselves are made. Well, you've got to put energy in order to be able to do that. And the energy, in the case of green plants, comes from sunlight, and in the case of other kinds of plants, comes from other sources, chemical sources. And in any case, reduction is what plants do on the earth, and so it's the other side of the endless biochemical cycle in which carbon, the basic atom of which biochemical substances are made, is endlessly recycled back and forth around the biosphere, and then out of the biosphere when the plants die, and back when the animals die, and back into it when the plants pick up that carbon, reincorporate it back into their own body. Pyroidic release, then, is the one which detects reduction, and as a result of the fact that it detects reduction, in which you don't need to give any substance aside from simple things that are present in the natural Martian environment, carbon dioxide, water vapor, and some sort of energy, for example, light, that means that pyroidic release can be a perfectly Martian experiment. You don't, as you do in labeled release, have to make assumptions about what nutrients are necessary for the Martian organisms to live, because you don't give them any nutrients. You simply give them normal Martian environment, and you assume that they are capable of taking the simple substances that make up that environment and building them up into their own substances in whatever way their little fancy dictates. So pyroidic release is the most Martian of the three experiments, and it is the one which hedges its bets about the question that, you remember, all three of them made different assumptions on, that is, how Earth-like must Martian life be, how Earth-like conditions are required for life to exist. It's the one that hedges its bets in the direction that Martian life are like Martian conditions. It is not 100% Martian, however. First of all, like all three of the experiments, it is way too warm. It is run at a temperature of 50 degrees Fahrenheit that is hotter than it ever gets at either of the two Viking landing sites, and it is almost hotter than it ever gets any place on Mars. The hottest it ever gets on Mars is around 80 degrees Fahrenheit down in the southern hemisphere, which you recall from Lecture 3, can get a good deal warmer than the northern hemisphere because of the two different kinds of seasonal effects running in phase in the southern hemisphere, out of phase in the northern. The second difference is that there is no ultraviolet light in pyroidic release, even though you can supply sunlight in case the energy that is required for the reduction to go comes from light as it does in the case of green plants and photosynthesis on the Earth. You filter out all the ultraviolet, and that is very un-Martian. On Mars, ultraviolet light from the sun comes all the way down to the surface and hits the surface. Now, the reason
that they did not include the ultraviolet light is that there is a way of fooling. There are no ways of fooling this experiment, in other words, of getting reduction to go in non-biological processes, but all of them that are known require ultraviolet light as a catalyst. And so if you take out the ultraviolet light, we don't know any way it can be done except by living organisms. The excuse that was given after it was realized they were going to have to filter out the ultraviolet is that ultraviolet kills things on Earth. Well, you remember I said last week, it ain't necessarily so on Mars. It is entirely possible that Martian organisms have developed ways of defending themselves against that ultraviolet. That's all right. But it's also possible, it's at least conceptually possible, that Martian organisms, since they are in that ultraviolet-rich environment, and since ultraviolet is such a rich energy source, have gotten to the point where they need the ultraviolet in order to go. Well, if so, pyrometric release is not providing them the fully natural Martian environment that they need. But other than that, it's the most Martian of the three experiments. Why is pyrometric release not at the right temperature? Because it's inside the biology package, and the biology package in the other two experiments contains these nutrients, which are liquids, which have to be kept liquid, which therefore cannot freeze, and therefore have got to be kept above the freezing point, well, not exactly the freezing point of water, but the freezing point of the nutrients, which is close to the freezing point of water. And so it turns out you've got to keep them about 50 degrees. The pyrometric release people are very anxious, and have been all throughout Viking, to run their experiment at a more natural margin temperature. The problem is that would destroy the other two experiments. And so the other two experimentees are not as enthusiastic about that idea as the pyrometric release team. So what is being done is the obvious compromise. They're waiting until the instrument is just about to die anyway, and it does have a built-in limit on its light, namely the amount of helium which runs all the things that are in it. And on Lander 2, which is the colder of the two landers since it is farther north, around about May, they're going to run out of helium, and so the last thing they're going to do is one grand, glorious kamikaze run of all three of the biology experiments, in which pyrolytic release will undoubtedly get through it, and the other two will not. We may or may not get some useful data from the other two before they're destroyed, and it may be interesting to see what those data are like, because the other two also are being run, have been run up to now, at abnormal conditions from a Martian point of view. So that will be coming up in May. It'll be interesting to look forward to. That's just one of several things that I'll tell you at the end of this lecture about what's coming up next, but I mentioned that because it's relevant to this context. Okay, the question of whether reduction requires light to make it go is, of course, one of the many things that we don't know about, and so, again, they hedge their bets, and pyrometric release can be run, and has been run now, either with the light on or with the light off. And the light very nicely simulates sunlight as it appears at the surface of Mars, except for the ultraviolet being filtered out. The question about whether light is necessary is one that may seem to have more obvious an answer to us now that we live in the era of photosynthesis on the Earth than is in fact the case. So let me point out to you that photosynthesis was only developed about a billion years ago, even here on the Earth, and life struggled along for at least 2 billion years without it. All known cells on Earth, even today, have ways of reducing, that is, of building up complex molecules out of simple molecules in the absence of light. And that includes animal cells. The overall effect of animals is to oxidize, not to reduce. But both kinds of reactions do, in fact, go on inside the body of both animals and plants. And so when I say animals do one, plants do the other. What I'm talking about is which predominates in animals, which predominates in plants. Animal cells do reduce with non-light processes, and so do cells which are capable of photosynthesizing when there is light. If you take a green plant and give it darkness, it is capable of reducing by non-light processes. Those are not nearly as efficient. Photosynthesis was a tremendous development when it finally did appear in evolution, because it was by far the most efficient means of energy production that had yet been developed. But there are other processes, fermentation for example, and there's no way that fermentation could keep a complex organism like you or even a tree, a green tree, going. But if you happen to be a yeast cell, fermentation is just great. you know, and we can all be, those of us who are beer fans can all be grateful that these cells, are still doing their thing and giving off their own particular toxic waste product, which is not oxygen the way the green plants are. We're grateful for that also, but another substance equally necessary to life. All right, the other thing that I wanted to say is very dear to my chicken scratching somewhere. Yeah, it is reasonable to assume that Martian life, whether or not it's invented photosynthesis, has means of reduction. If you will grant me the assumption, which we talked about in detail last week, that Martian life is made of organic, that is carbon-based compounds. Because the carbon is going to be a limited supply, and if you have organisms that are made of organic molecules, complex carbon-based molecules, when they die, they are going to break down spontaneously, naturally, into simpler molecules. Those simpler molecules are gases, and the carbon has got to be recycled somehow, and there's got to be some process of getting those gases, which are widely dispersed through the environment, back into the biosphere, and it's going to have to be some sort of reduction process. What the details are, you can't say in that simple argument, but there's got to be some process somewhere. So what I'm saying is the carbon has got to be recycled through the air on Mars, and that is entirely reasonable. The air on Mars, after all, is 95% carbon dioxide. On the Earth, the big reservoir of non-biological carbon at any given moment, in other words, the carbon at the moment is out of the biosphere and hasn't yet entered back into it, is in the ground. On Mars, it may very well be in the air, since the air is mostly carbon dioxide. And so what we're saying is the pyrolytic release detects the carbon at the point where it re-enters the biosphere, at the point where the reducing organisms, called the plants for simplicity, that's what we would call them on Earth, where the reducing organisms take the carbon back out of the air and put it back into their own bodies, which is, re-enters the biosphere. Because here's the way pyrolytic release works. It, too, is used as radioactive detection so that it will not get fooled by natural substances that are present in the Martian environment anyway, non-biological. It gives its Martian soil sample an artificial Martian atmosphere whose composition is essentially that of the real thing. It has a lot of carbon dioxide in it and a very small amount of carbon monoxide, which is also a source of carbon. And we think of it as poisonous, but there are lots of bacteria which use carbon monoxide for the carbon in it. It's poisonous to us because we happen to be, fragile and delicate because we're complex organisms. Microorganisms, a lot of them can take it in stride. In any case, mostly it's carbon dioxide. All the carbon atoms are radioactively labeled so that you can trace them. And what pyrolytic release does is it exposes the soil sample to this artificial Martian environment. You have the option of either giving it or not giving it water vapor in amounts excess of that present normally in the Martian environment. And of course, since the whole thing about pyrolytic release is you're trying to be as Martian as possible, the first runs were done just with the natural amount of water vapor that was present in the Martian environment. And then later on, they tried adding a little more to see if it would pep up the result any. You then just sit there and let it cook and let the organisms in the soil, assuming there are any, take in this radioactively labeled carbon dioxide, build it up into their own bodies, and then, at the end of the run, you detect any organic molecules which are radioactively labeled that may have been built up during the time that you were running the experiment. And there is a clever way to build in the experiment, which I won't describe in detail unless somebody really wants all the technical details, of differentiating organic molecules that have been built up in the ground in your experiment chamber from the carbon molecules which are still radioactively labeled and are just left over in the carbon dioxide still in the experiment chamber and hasn't been used up by the little BCs while you're running the experiment. And it is a very, very efficient and sensitive way of doing this. You get rid of all the carbon dioxide and then you detect the organic molecule, and the method of detection is really foolproof. It is not going to give you a positive unless organic molecules themselves have really been detected, and fairly complex ones at that. The method of detection does not, unfortunately, tell you which organic molecules have been built up. That, of course, is what we'd really be interested in. But first of all, let's find out whether any are built up. It just turned out to be too complicated to build in a way that would find out which ones they were on top of everything else. There is, of course, a separate experiment which looks for natural organic molecules in the Martian soil. And bear in mind, they would not be present in any lower concentration than they would be in the pyrolytic release experiment, because the pyrolytic release experiment simply duplicates the natural Martian environment. You're not culturing them in the sense the other two do. You're not giving them abnormal amounts of nutrient by Martian standards and then hoping they'll build themselves up to a bigger number than they are present on Mars. And so the method of detection involves, as it turns out, breaking down the organic molecules back into carbon dioxide again, and then detecting back carbon dioxide, okay? So if you get a positive, you know something is happening, you don't know exactly what. The first step is to get a positive, if there is one. The next step is to worry about sending something else back to Mars and finding out exactly what it was that happened. The thing I want to emphasize to you is that this is a very, very difficult experiment to pool. The other two can pick up non-living chemical reactions. This one, however, will give you a positive only if, number one, complex organic molecules have been built up, number two, out of the carbon dioxide that you gave them, in other words, they weren't there in the Martian soil when you picked up that soil and dumped it in the experiment, and number three, therefore, during the time the experiment itself was running. So that is a very, very specific and hard to fool set of requirements. And there's only one way that we know of the pool, as I say, and that is that there is a set of reactions which can reduce in the way that I've talked about, but non-biologically, but which requires ultraviolet light to make it go. And so without the ultraviolet light, the only way that we know of on Earth that can do this kind of thing is by biology. Now, the results that I'm going to give you are not going to be the same sort of thing that I did last week for pyrolytic for label release. In label release, what you were doing was observing the amount of carbon dioxide that came out as you went along. If you follow my description of pyrolytic release, you will observe that you do not do the detection until the very end of the experiment, right? And so in pyrolytic release, you don't have the chance to watch the growth and decay curve. This is what you have given up in order to have the totally Martian environment and in order to have it undisturbed during the time the experiment is running. So what you do is you simply let it sit in there and let the Martian organisms do exactly what they would do outside of the natural Mars, and then after they have been doing that for what you consider a long enough time, then you just dump the entire thing, break them down back into carbon dioxide, and you take that carbon dioxide, and the only result that you get is a number which tells you how much organic material has been built up in the experiment chamber during the time that you were running. And that is presumably the bodies of the microbes themselves, if you've gotten anything at all. Okay, so all I can do for each one is give you a number, just one single number, and that is the result of my release for a particular run. Alright, so what I'm going to do is write out a long table here, in which we start out at the top by telling you which lander it is, Viking lander number, and which run it is, or cycle, as the experimenters always say, but run is a shorter word, and so it fits into my table better. And then I'll tell you the kind of the experiment, and finally I will tell you the result, and that'll just be one particular number. Okay, the first time that the experiment was ever run, which was, of course, on Viking Lander 1, cycle number 1, it was run at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and it was dry, they did not add extra water vapor, and they did have the light on, and so I'll call that dry and light as opposed to, for example, wet or dark. And let me explain to you that, as with any experiment, it is possible to get a small region even when in fact there is nothing there, just because of the experiment design. For example, the mechanism which flushes out the unused carbon dioxide before you then break down the organic chemicals and see what you detected, that mechanism is not absolutely 100% efficient. And in test runs on the Earth, they had attained numbers as high as 15. It doesn't matter what these numbers are, they are counts per minute in the radioactivity detector and the instrument is what they are. But what matters is comparison. You know, if we get a number that's 15, nobody's going to get excited. If we get a number that's 107, you know, you're going to get much more excited. It's way above 15. And so you don't get excited if you get a number that isn't zero. You don't get excited if it is above, unless it's above 15. And what they got on the first run was, in fact, 95. Now, by Earth standards, that's still a small number. you dump Iowa farm soil into this thing, you get a couple of fouls. Nevertheless, there are lots of relatively infertile soils on Earth for which 95 would be a very good, impressive kind of number. And that number was and is perhaps the best single piece of evidence for the existence of life on Mars today. I suppose the Wendell Rooney people might give me an argument about that, and some of them are kind of fond of some of the results that they got too, particularly the temperature sensitivity of the results. Nevertheless, I think most of us would take that number as being a very, very good number if you think there is Martian life. Okay, well, you remember, if you were here last week, the first thing you do when you have obtained what looks like a good positive is you rerun it at soil heat to 320 degrees Fahrenheit, a temperature that is not high by the standards of most non-living chemistry, but is hot enough to kill anything that's alive on the Earth, since living chemistry is so much more sensitive to temperature than most non-living chemistry. In other words, you do what is called a control experiment, and so that was the second run on Lander 1. And so I'll put down 320 degrees Fahrenheit. Otherwise, of course, you duplicate the first run, and so it also was dry and light, and the number they got was 15. And so obviously that strengthens the case that the 95 was light. And at that point, some of us began to get cautiously excited. What they tried to do then, and again, you remember the same pattern we went through last week on label release. If you have gotten what looks like a good number, and you've gotten what looks like a good number, I mean a low number, on the control experiment, biology is so complicated you never really believe the good one until you've duplicated it, and so you try to get a duplicate of the first one. And so Lander 1, cycle 3, was intended to be another 50 degrees dry and light. However, that was the same run, if you remember from last week, in which the temperature controls in the instrument didn't work properly, and until they were able to get them fixed. For the first 3 days, in fact, the soil was heated a little bit higher than it should have been. It was 80 degrees Fahrenheit instead of 50. And then went back down to 50 for the rest of the run. And each of these runs, by the way, is about 10 days. And so I'll put that as a shorthand here, 80 degrees Fahrenheit. You'll understand that only means for the first 3 days. But the point is that it was a different kind of temperature. And that, again, of course, was dry and light. And the number they got was 28. That is further evidence for life. Because this implies that the reaction we're seeing is really temperature sensitive. It is awfully hard to find non-living chemistry in which any of the substances involved are so temperature sensitive that simply increasing the temperature from 50 degrees to 80 degrees is going to have this drastic effect on it. Okay? And so at this point, some people were feeling cautiously euphoric. Cautious euphoria in searching my own space program. Okay. What they then tried to do, and I'm actually looking ahead of the game here now in the interest of simplicity. I'm not giving this to you strictly chronologically. By now, Lander 2 would begun to run higher with release also. However, I'm going to give you the final run. It wasn't the final run, I'm sorry. I'm going to give you the fourth run on Lander 1, which was an attempt to duplicate the first. And it was 50. The instrument was working well by this time. And it was dry and it was light. And the number they got, I'm not going to tell you because if I told you, it would look as though it wasn't the same number. By this time, a considerable amount of the instrument's carbon dioxide had been used up. The number they got was a lower number than the 95. However, if you take the ratio of the amount of carbon dioxide that was left in the experiment to the number that they got, it was, in fact, the same. Okay, it really did duplicate the first run, even though if I wrote the number down, it wouldn't seem it. And so what I'm going to do is write 95 of the bar through it so you understand, you know, the equivalent of that 95 the first time, although the number was not itself 95. All right. On Lander 2, the first run was... I'm sorry. The first run was 50 degrees Fahrenheit again. But by this time, you know, Lander 1, they'd already gone through the thing about duplicating it, and so they were trying to find out some other things. And you say, well, gee, they landed another place, you know, maybe the chemistry is going to be different. But by this time, it was pretty obvious from the other biology instruments and from the non-biological instruments that in fact the soil temperature is very, very similar at the two landing sites. And so the first run on Lander 2, they tried something different. They tried doing it in the dark. And this was again dry, but it was dark, not light. And the idea of this was simply to find out whether this reduction, which we are seeing in the 50 degree dry light run, whether it was biological or not, is it something that requires light to make it go? And it turned out that, in fact, it just about is. Remember, 15 is the highest background that they ever got on Earth, and the reaction, the results they got there was 21. And that isn't exactly 15, but it was close enough to it that the experimenters were pretty much willing to accept that as being essentially zero. So whatever this thing is, whether it is biological or not, it requires light. If it is biology, it's photosynthesis, or something broader, which you call photosynthesis, they don't guarantee it's the same reaction. And if it is not biological, it is certainly some sort of photochemical reaction, which requires visible light to make it go, not ultraviolet. All right. Now, the second run on Lander 2, I would think it's Lander 2 here, the second run on Lander 2, they did, again, at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and this time they tried doing it with the extra water vapor, which the experiment team insists on calling the wet mode. Of course, it's not wet, this is water vapor, not liquid water. Liquid water is not used in this experiment, it's too un-Martian. The most they're willing to bend their Martian environment is by giving a little bit more water vapor than necessarily needs. However, water vapor is, in the first place,